Hi, I'm Bob Keeling, author of Good Day Sunshine State, and I'm talking the Beatles and rock and roll with Dave and Shane.
You're like a well-oiled machine, man.
Why do you say awesome. That? Why do you wait to say that once we're on? Just kidding.
Oh, oh Dave.
Hi, everybody. This is Rob Halford.
Rudy Sargent.
Hi there. This is Steve Hackett.
You folks are just recommending a triumph. And we're talking rock with Dave and Shane.
Oh, yeah.
Bobby.
This is awesome.
Oh, what's good? Up, man? Oh,
yeah. I got to get a serious shot of this.
Happy anniversary, by the way, man, right?
Yes.
4 years?
Yeah, man.
4 years. 4 years.
It's awesome.
Very cool.
Yeah,
that's
man.
Great. Congratulations.
It's hard to believe how much time has gone by.
That's right, so Davey? Cool. Oh, yeah, dude. That's awesome. Congrats, my brother. That's
awesome. It's good seeing you, Bobby.
Oh, right back at you, Shainer. Look at you, brother. Yeah, yeah. It's good to be back with you, you know, virtually, whatever. I'll take it. I don't care.
Yeah.
I think it's been 25 years since wow. we worked together. That's mind blowing.
Yeah, I was in my early 20s when we worked together, Bob.
Well, I was bragging about you before you came online here. And, you know, I was just telling Dave, you know, what a soulful cat you were way back in the day. And man, the 90s were trying times down here in O-Town. Woo.
Yeah.
All kinds of calamities. And
is that right? God, oh, man.
Oh.
Killer twist, yeah, killer twisters, hurricanes.
Wow.
Whole counties on fire and evacuations. It was crazy.
Oh, yeah, man.
98, the only thing we didn't have was the plague of locusts in 98. Yeah, everything right. else.
That's true. Man,
it was that crazy. Oh, God. My God.
Oh, it was horrible.
Wow, man.
And, Bob, you got out of news and shortly after. I mean,
17. I put in my 25 years at WESH, and then we have this really – cool progressive sheriff who took over after Esslinger up here in Seminole County, and it's just a dream gig. And yeah, so it's gone well, but I'm sure as hell not out of storytelling, baby. I've just started.
Pursue a huge passion project like this. Good Day Sunshine State, How the Beatles Rocked Florida. Shane, you're the producer extraordinaire here, man. You connected us to Bob and this book, and it's phenomenal. The stories are amazing, and it looks like it was a fun read, right, Shane? And it must have
amazing.
Been fun to do, Bob. Must have been so fun to put this together.
Well, I'm the youngest of six kids, and so while the other kids were listening to, like, bubblegum music and things, I'm listening to Revolver and, you know, Hard Day's Night, and yeah. that got me started early. And then when I started learning about all of the interesting things that they did here in Florida in 64, I knew I had a book and I was ready to rock and roll. And, you know, having all of these primary sources like the great Larry Kane spend so much time with me was not only flattering, but it just made the book so much better because you're right there. You're right there with them every step of the way.
Yeah. And Larry gave your book quite a review recently, didn't he? Larry wrote When They Were Boys, Beatles book for when he traveled with the Beatles. He was embedded with them for how long was that? How long was he with them?
Yeah, he covered both American tours of 64 and 65. And, you know, he also wrote the wonderful book Ticket to Ride. And, you know, Larry has quite the first person perspective. And then, you know, he just filed a review on this book on Amazon, and it just blew me away. It was incredibly generous.
Yeah, he's a good guy.
Yeah, well, he is.
Diving into this book, Bob, I mean, first thing I got to say is John, when he was young, was a rapscallion initially to people. He was not the nicest guy. He talked before, he thinks. He's impatient. You know, pretty much all the qualities that come with a early youngster growing up in Liverpool. I mean, talk a little bit about John and what he was like when he first came over to America.
Well, it was pretty amazing to think, that, you know, the Beatles are really starting to hit that precipice of fame in 64. And let's go through the eyes of young Larry Kane, who's 21 years old. He requests one interview with them in Jacksonville when the Beatles come back because he's a Miami newsman. And instead, Brian invites him on the whole tour. And he's like, okay, great. Well, so he gets on a plane. He gets out in San Francisco. It's the very beginning of this behemoth North American tour. And Brian Epstein is having Larry in for all of the niceties, pleasantries in San Francisco. And Larry walks in, and the first thing Lennon says to him is, why are you dressed like, let's say, a sissy? That was the word they used back then, but it was a much more abrupt word. And that was John. And that's what Larry Kane even said to me. He said, you know, in a way, John was very much like Donald Trump, another guy who sort of says things off the top of his head. He could be very endearing or he could be a big turnoff. But Larry and John ended up being very close friends for years.
Yeah.
For him to see that, for Larry to, you know, kind of witness, do you think in a way was like a culture shock with John? I mean, you know, that year, I mean, that fame rising, coming to the States, I mean, was like, how much of that did Larry think was just, you know, a major culture shock for these guys from, you know, Liverpool? I mean,
There's just no doubt about it. You know, John, of course, is the leader, but he has an extra bit of tension, bit of stress as he's in America for the first time. His wife's with him. And it's tough being a married guy, you know, trying to rush into limousines. And he has his lovely, demure wife, Cynthia, with him. And she's not trying to share the spotlight or become famous off of her husband. She's just trying to enjoy some of the fruits of their developing success because she had been his lady in waiting for so long. But in terms of the Beatles, let's say just for the title of this book, you know, Sunshine State, Coming to Florida, I very much contend that this is where the Beatles fell in love with America, coming to Miami Beach for the first time, seeing sand, palm trees, beautiful young women. These are guys from workaday, cloudy, dreary, industrial England coming to America. And it's like this whole country just coming into full flower. And oh, by the way, they're number one on both the single and album charts. It was just all of their dreams coming true.
And all of this was happening in short time around when they were in Miami, right?
Yeah, they were in Miami to do their second Sullivan Show appearance. And they loved it so much, they just announced, yeah, we're going to stay another week. You know, we're going to go on vacation. And of course, their bodyguard's like, oh, my God, OK, I've got to stay with these guys another week.
But logistics.
Logistics and then some. And they meet the brash young Cassius Clay, who's on his rise to fame as well. Malcolm X is with him, trying to convince him to become a full-time member of the Nation of Islam. This was just such a watershed year in Florida in 64. But the book is about much more than Florida. And they go on, you know, like, for instance, it's Larry Kane's travels with the Beatles all over the United States and in places like Detroit and San Francisco and Las Vegas, where the Beatles draw the line in the sand very quickly, saying, when we go back to the South, we are not going to play to segregated shows. And that was a really courageous stand. And Shane, I think this goes back to what you were talking about with John. You know, they just said, we're not going to do it. And that's it. And that was a very risky thing to do back in 64 in the pre-civil rights era of America. Yeah.
Sure was.
Was it? Go ahead, Shane. Yeah.
No, you, Davey.
No, I was just going to say, like, that whole, this is like the 60s all in one year almost right here. I mean, you got Cassius Clay, you got Malcolm X, you got, you know, the Beatles, you know, in America witnessing. And like you said, it's not just, you know, you touch on the other cities too, like, kind of getting that, you know, they see the blue collar spirit of America, they see kind of the leisure of America, all these things. It's like the 60s all in one year almost. It's incredible when you think about it in a way.
Well, when you look at the picture from the tour that's in the book, it looks like America today. you know, there's a lot of African American artists on the tour. You know, you have the Exciters, you have Clarence Frogman Henry, and the Beatles just weren't going to stand for them being treated as second class citizens. It was just so foreign to them. And that was the wonderful thing about Larry Kane being on tour with them, is he would ask them these thought provoking questions. And it was actually Paul in Vegas who was one of the first ones to say, you know, we just don't get how, and the term was acceptable back then, you know, colored people are treated like animals here in the United States. And we don't get it. It's foreign to us. I wouldn't mind if one was sitting next to me right now. And in Detroit on September 6th, when they were asked, who are your favorite artists? They're like, oh, we love the Motown people. We love Marvin Gaye and Mary Wells. And you just see how far ahead of their time they were. They're denouncing Vietnam at the same time. They really got it. And I think having Larry Kane with them helped them expand on their intellectual curiosity and their growing worldview, even though all of them were just kids. I mean, George was only 20 at the time, and John was the grand old man at 23.
This is like a bit of a rock history here, but this was there was probably a nod to the Beatles. But when Ian from the Stone Roses was interviewed by NME in the early 90s, they were absolutely blown away and taken back. They almost considered not playing because the Confederate flag was still flying on top of the Capitol there, and in Georgia when they were passing through. And it was just mind blowing to them that how America doesn't seem to want to move forward, you know, in certain parts of the country. And that, I mean, the Beatles really laid the groundwork for a lot of that.
And one of the things I think is so compelling about the last third of my book, I call it innocence, influence, and activism. Those are the parts of the book as it evolves. To see how close they were, not only philosophically with Dr. King, who was all over Florida in 64 as well. Let's just add him to the mix too.
Yeah.
So they were following very closely in his footsteps. And in fact, just weeks apart in the summer of 64, they were on the same street as Dr. King and extolling this same notion of, yeah, no, we're not going to stay in this hotel if they're not going to offer our, you know, the black artists here the same accommodations as we're getting. And earlier in June of that year, Dr. King was next door in the federal courthouse testifying because he had gotten arrested for wanting to sit with white friends at the Monson Motor Lodge in St. Augustine. And then they took him up to Jacksonville to keep him for safekeeping. And he was held in solitary confinement. And it was a hearing with this incredibly important federal judge named Brian Simpson, who was making these decisions about the ongoing nonviolent protests that were happening in St. Augustine in the lead up to the Beatles playing there. So yeah, the Beatles knew what was going on with the struggle in St. Augustine in Florida. They knew Miami Beach was segregated when they were there. There's a great picture of them in Buddy Dresner's police cruiser with the windows down, and they're talking to maids who were in their uniforms sitting at the bus stop. So they were very much in tune with the struggles of others and were absolutely adamant about equality. And it was a privilege to talk to Lillian Walker of the Exciters, who said, yeah, you know, the Beatles could have a blast. We could have a great time. We could listen to music on the airplane. But when it came to something serious like equal rights, that kind of thing, you know, they were not going to budge. So that's a big part of this story.
It seems interesting that, you know, that early on, the Beatles caught on to something that, you know, we just, you know, as a country couldn't get on the same page on. And I'm wondering, is that the power of music? I mean, their draw to American culture and that ability to, you know, like their love, their interest in Motown, their interest in all these different types of music. And you extend that, and there's an interest in people, like all different mm-hmm. types of people. It's just a beautiful thing. And it's, mm-hmm. it's, you know, terrible to think that, you know, at that time, you know, the rest of the country just couldn't get it together the way these guys, you know, had that perspective, you know?
Well, and I think that can be sort of encapsulated in the experience of, you know, the first guy we meet in the book, this fella named John Trusty, who was a Navy man down in Key West, which is the furthest reaches of Florida. You're only 90 miles from Cuba. And he's at this Key Wester nightclub, and he's having a few drinks, and he almost runs over Paul McCartney as they're both trying to pick up on the same chicks. And then he runs into John Lennon and has a memorable encounter. And so it that part's all fun. But then he says, you know, I walk out into the swimming pool area of this motel resort, and there's Ringo swimming with members of the Exciters, you know, these black women in a swimming pool. And he's taken aback, not because he has a problem with it, but because he knows how unusual it is. And it's just, it's almost farcical to think of that today, because Key West is such a freewheeling place. But even back then, pre-Civil Rights Act 64, or just past the, just after the passing of that important act and signed by Lyndon Johnson, it was a big deal for whites and blacks to be in the same pool. And I think that's kind of it in a nutshell. You see how things are starting to evolve. And the Beatles were certainly agents of change. They helped make it happen.
Just to get this out of the way, the Key Wester jam with the Beatles, Exciters, was Clyde in on that too? I forget, Clyde McFadder.
No, it was there was a local musician who I had the privilege to interview. Coffee Butler is his name.
Yes, that's
nickname. But yeah, oh yeah, he was in on the jam session for sure. And he told me this great story. You know, he goes, yeah, my manager Herb Rosenberg, you know, I'd finish my gig downtown, and he called out to the Key Wester and said, I got a black Beatle I want you to meet. And he said that with this wonderful smile on his face, you know, as I was interviewing him during the COVID era. You know, he's into his 90s.
Yeah.
So yeah, he was there, and that was quite the jam session of the Beatles in Key West.
No known recording of that jam, is there?
Boy, I wish there were. And I'll say another thing, the little cabana where they stayed down there is now the only standing building in Florida where we can say the Beatles slept here.
Wow.
And I would love to get that place landmarked before we knock it down and turn it into a Starbucks or something. And that, you know, that brings up the tragedy of what happened with the Deauville Hotel, where they appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show live in front of 70 million people. And unfortunately, we fought hard to try to save it. But these owners, we'll just leave it at that, let the building decay. And it turned into a court issue, and it was just imploded in the last year and a half or so. And I would argue that was one of the top three Beatle landmarks in North America. And it's just, it's a tragedy, and it's just a disgrace what happened to that place where the Beatles stayed. You know, a week and a half, they wrote songs there. And as I said before, that's where they fell in love with America. But, you know, we can't save all of the landmarks, but I sure wish we could have saved that one.
Yeah, you think that, I agree. I mean, that certainly that's right there. That's the precipice of them, like you said, falling in love with America as artists, taking in what they see, what they hear, what they feel, writing about it. You know, that's, I mean, it was a production factory in a way right there, you know, it's striking because the Beatles are so seminal to our culture. You know, you see them, there's references everywhere, obviously. They're ingrained in our tapestry, and yet we couldn't save such a I mean, that could be, you know, I don't want to say ground zero for that, but really kind of ground zero for that amazing, you know, cultural force.
Oh, and when you think about how, you know, retro history is such a big deal, and there could have been an Abbey Road district there in South Beach. There would have been so many ways. Now, I will say that there are still plans as to what they're going to build in its place. And I hope that it will be done with some respect towards the Beatles, but they're starting from a vacant lot that's right there on the ocean. And it's hard to really do anything that has any sort of, you know, genuineness to it, because it's all gone now. I'd even gone so far as getting a commitment from Hard Rock to save the stage that they appeared on in Sullivan, but now that had to go too. So that's something we need to work on down here, is doing a better job of preserving our landmarks. And one of the things I hope to do through this book is provide the provenance for that building in Key West to be landmarked as well, because they had a brief but very eventful history when they spent a couple, 2.5, 3 days in Key West as they waited for the hurricane to go through Jacksonville so they could play the Gator Bowl.
And one of the things about you, Bob, you have a long history of helping historical sites get preserved in Florida. You've worked on quite a few. Can you just run down a list of some of the ones that you helped, you know, Derry Down being one, Jack Kerouac's house, another, but just kind of talk about why that struck a chord with you. And initially when you were talking to me about this book, that sounded like one of the main reasons you wanted to get this book out was for the Deauville.
Absolutely. And one of the wonderful sort of serendipitous side effects of these books is I tend to run into places that are ripe for historic preservation. And, you know, with my first book, Kerouac in Florida, it was Jack Kerouac's house where he was living when On the Road was published. It's here in Orlando. And it basically made him the literary Elvis of his generation. You mentioned the Derry Down in Winter Haven. That's an old teen club for the tragic country rock artist Graham Parsons. He was in the Byrds. He discovered Emmylou Harris, and then he died tragically in his 20s. And now it's a historic listening room. We've had Chris Hillman there, his bandmate from the Byrds. And I mean, you want to talk about an emotional evening. That was really something. And we've also done recent landmarks to the Allman Brothers house where they, you know, first formed in Jacksonville. By the way, they're not a Macon, Georgia band. They are from Florida. They have Florida roots. They grew up here. They played here. Dwayne and Greg, especially in Daytona Beach Shores. And then we just did a marker for Lynyrd Skynyrd also. You know, I wanted to mention that with Gary Rossington's passing. But it's right on the little dock in the Hell House property in Green Cove Springs where they would write their songs. And when Ronnie was stuck and he couldn't come up with something, he'd stand there on the dock and fish right on the creek. And that's where the marker is now. So the feeling is, if, you know, people like us history nerds don't, you know, preserve and draw attention to this kind of stuff, who will?
Yeah. It's a whole new dynamic too of like, feeling the music, you know, seeing the shows. If you were blessed to see some of these groups back then, of course you're going way back, obviously with the Beatles, but then also to walk into these places and take it all in. It reinvigorates the senses, I think, you know?
Yeah. And in fact, what I call it is I feel the vibrations of history in these places. I don't care, like this Derry Down place, I could have damn near pushed it over when, you know, Graham Parsons' buddy showed it to me. And it's right on the edge of downtown Winter Haven. And now there's an ensuite hotel going up right next to it. And you think, oh, God, that's terrible. No, it's great. Yeah. This dilapidated old building is now sparking redevelopment right downtown. There's also going to be a restaurant on the other side of it. So now when you go to a show, you can stay right next door. It's all walking distance. It's wonderful. So that is a big part of it. And I'll say too, in this book, you talked about, you know, the Beatles shows were so long ago, but in bringing the book to an end without giving the end away, to see and have encounters with both living Beatles really, really sets it in stone that Beatlemania is still very much alive and well, 60 years on now.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's still, I mean, every year there's another Beatles release that comes out. I have several friends, I don't know why that would be, that operate record stores, and the Beatles are still, there's a little bit of slope in the last few years, but kids are still the number one, you know, buyers of their music. So the legacy lives on.
And I think that's a testament to the quality of the music too. And if you see these guys now in their 80s as performers, Paul was magnificent and was on stage for 2 hours and 45 minutes. And that was after he did a half an hour sound check. Wow. And it was God awful hot down here. Yeah. But hey, you know, you could just tell Paul is alive when he's on stage. I mean, that's what he lives for, I would venture to say. And I had a memorable encounter with Ringo after seeing he and the All-Stars at the Ryman Auditorium in Nashville,
nice.
You know, the mother church of country music. And that was another just great time. So it kind of brings it all current and just just great fun.
The Good Day Sunshine State, Bob, just a tremendous number of characters in this book, very memorable characters. Buddy Dresner, obviously being my favorite.
The bodyguard, yeah.
Yeah. Played by Colin Hanks in the movie, by the way. Now,
your mouth to God's ears.
I don't know. Yes. But you have Buddy was a policeman assigned to Beatles detail. You also had African American fan early on in the book, stewardess, many other Eddie fans.
Oliver, yep.
People in the right place at the right time. I guess my question really is, you know, we dig in news, we dig in television news, but how on earth did you find all these people? Like, how did you go about the initial spark of this book and then finding these people? And I guess they just one led to another.
Yeah, usually that is the case. And sometimes, like, for instance, finding Larry Kane, there was a guy in the news business I worked with who worked with Larry up in Philly. And he said, sure, I'll, you know, hit him up for you. And that's how that worked. Another time, it was as simple as going to John Lowengard's website. That name may not ring a bell, but he's the guy who took the iconic picture of the Beatles bobbing heads for Life magazine, which is one of the most iconic pictures that ever ran in that magazine. I emailed him, and I think it was the same day, maybe a few hours later. Yeah, sure. What can I do to help?
Wow.
And, you know, Gail Cameron, the reporter for Life magazine, her son had a website. And so I contacted him first. And I think generally speaking, for folks who are excited about writing about this kind of history, there's an important lesson here. A lot of these folks, Reggie Young of the Memphis Boys is another one. You know, I talked to him as the rain's falling on the back porch of his home in Nashville. He had just had a stroke and he passed away 2 months later. But, you know, these are people who are on in years. And I think they're anxious to share their stories, especially if you're respectful about it. And if you're lucky enough to have a person who knows them vouch for you. You know, so that's to me, that's what it's all about, is primary sources. I was lucky enough to interview more than 30 for this book, and about 6 or 7 of them have passed away since the book came out, you know, or in the time before the book came out. So, you know, the clock's ticking and it's important to get their stories. And I was privileged to do that here. And I think that's why if the book is enjoyable and it gives you a feel like you're in the front seat for this joyride that was the Beatles in North America in 64, it's because of those folks.
It's amazing, like, you know, oral history and how you can, you know, those stories translate. But like you said, the time is just running so short. And it's interesting because we've lost, you know, as you know, so many icons. I mean, you know, David Crosby, Jeff Beck, you know, Christine McVie, all these various people across music. But it's not just them, it's the people, it's these direct eye and ear witnesses, like the folks you've interviewed who we're losing too. And that's a whole different perspective on it all.
Yeah. You know, I would have never had the privilege of writing this book had I not had an original angle to the story. Everybody and their mother wanted to write about, you know, the Beatles in Florida. Oh, doesn't that sound fun? And sure, but you got to get beyond Google searches. Yeah. You know, guys like you, you know, this isn't your first rodeo. If you saw, oh, this is from Teen Beat magazine. Oh, well, that's not very interesting. That's not very original. Yeah. You know, it's the guys like Larry Kane who weren't the DJs, you know, going on tour with them and asking them provocative, interesting questions, because he's a newsman. You know, he knows that's what you do to get the important content. And he was a syndicated reporter for all of this. So he was reporting for radio stations all over the country. But, you know, that's important. You've got to get to those primary sources to do something that's original. And the other thing I was lucky to do was get into the Hard Rock Collection. Jeff Nolan here in Orlando got me access to, like, handwritten letters from Paul McCartney to Buddy Dresner. This wonderful piece of artwork that Buddy had taken as a gift from the Beatles, they signed for him. And then he just kind of left it on his sun porch in the back and it got rained on. this thing's worth a lot of money. But the, yeah. but the neat part in the book was the guy who had done it initially and given it to the Beatles thinking it might be an album cover never knew what happened to it. So I was able to tell him 55 years later, okay, here's the progression of what happened to your artwork.
Was that picture, which was like an ink blot type mm-hmm. style thing. It actually looked like the Beatles.
Yeah. And, the, and that's why it's they thought it might be a cool album cover.
Yeah. Yeah. It actually, cool. it's a really fascinating little piece of art, but that was that hanging in the, I just slipped the name
of the Heart Rock.
Yeah. The Heart was it yes. hanging on the wall when they saw it finally?
Yes. And, but see, they didn't know the progression of what had happened to it. They're just like, what the hell? Where did this thing come from? Right. And it's signed by all four of the Beatles. Oh my God. And so, with Buddy's son, Barry, by the way, who has lovingly recorded all of his father's history with the Beatles in a website called buddyandthebeatles.com, which is wonderful. I was able to find out the history of what happened to that wonderful piece of artwork. So it's another little Beatle mystery solved. And I was able to, you know, let Don and his wife know what had happened before he, you know, passed away. So it was good that they finally solved that mystery. They got the answer.
Yeah. It's amazing. We're talking with the author of Good Days, Sunshine State, How the Beatles Rock Florida, Bob Keeling, of sunny Florida. And Bob, you know, one of the questions I had with you know, Larry Kane and his kind of direct perspectives on all this was, did he, you know, as this was happening, I mean, did he have an idea? I mean, the answer is yes, based on just everything that you've covered. But at the time, did Larry have an idea the magnitude of what was happening?
You know, well, I think it's a great question. I think it's a great question, because initially, no.
Yeah.
When they assigned him to cover the Beatles, he's kind of pissed off. He's like, look, can I say that? I hope I can.
Yeah,
you know? Sure.
We've had people say worse.
Well, it's a rock and roll show.
That's
come
right.
On.
You got it. That's right.
Yeah, the Swedish Michael Bolton said much worse.
Okay, good. Rock to Michael. You know, he's down in South Florida covering, you know, the Cuban Missile Crisis and civil rights and things like that. And he's like, I got to cover some pop band, you know, because remember, there were no successful English acts that had come to Florida before the Beatles. So to him, it's like, I've got to go cover the arrival at the airport. What is this crap? And and then so all of a sudden, the panes of glass from the terminal at the airport start falling down on the runway and crash, you know, and he's like, Jesus. So that was a revelation. The girl screaming and having this sort of, you know, sexualized, excited behavior because of the Beatles, that was new. So intuitively, he starts thinking, yeah, we've got some real cultural change going on. And that's why he wrote them a letter requesting an interview with them in Jacksonville. And Brian writes back that summer going, yeah, you'd be welcome to join us on the whole tour. And so he talks to his mom and dad, and his dad's like, no, you need to stay away from them. Those guys are bad news. But his mom's, you know, like, no, this could change your career. It could change your life. And sure enough, it did. So his attitude evolved. He didn't initially see them as this huge cultural event, but in pretty short order, he did.
Yeah, the airport, you painted such a great picture in the book with using a lot of the photographers, Charles Trainer, John from Life, Dizo Hoffman, the Beatles photographer, talking about.
Harry Benson's another one.
Yeah, talking about, you know, the glass shattering, the screaming, all the kids on the roof. It was a major cultural shift. That band, weren't they? I mean, Elvis was one thing,
no doubt.
Little Richard was another, but the Beatles, that Ed right. Sullivan performance, just what did that do to America?
It was seismic. And I think Tom Petty's take is really apt here. You know, this is the influence part of the book where it's all of these would-be musicians here in the Sunshine State. And Petty was like, literally, it was like the world went from black and white to color. seeing the Beatles. And all of a sudden, it's this collective of guys. And you didn't have to look like Elvis to be a star. And that was a big deal. And then the Stones coming on the heels of the Beatles. It was like, yeah. That was inspiring for guys who may not have been the most handsome dudes, you know, and but wanted to grab a guitar and start getting girls, you know, because after all, if they're not athletes and they're not good looking, that's the only way to get the chicks, you know. So, yeah, they were absolutely cultural agents of change. And to come in here and you know, make these demands. And I mean, there was line number 6 on the writer of their North American contract at the very beginning said artists will not be required to play in front of segregated audiences. And, you know, that may have been Brian Epstein. It may have been John. That was never specific, but that was a real line in the sand, and it was a risky thing to do. And they loved being photographed with Little Richard or Fats Domino, any of those folks, because they revered these artists and they thought it's ridiculous to discriminate against them. You know, help, we appropriate their culture. What, you know,
yeah.
The least we can do is treat them as equals.
Right.
You can hear so much of the Coasters sound and Ringo's playing too. It's kind of funny. And he was a big fan of them. He's, you know, they went to see them when they were down there. Dave, go for it.
Yeah, no, I was just, no, you're right. I mean, I that's what's always fascinated me is that idea of, you know, these guys, you know, the rhythm section, the drums, the bass, you know, so much of that you can pull out those influences. And, you know, as a sort of casual Beatles fan, you know, listener, you don't think about that at first, but then when you read this book, you're like, oh yeah, I could see how they picked this, how this came from there, or this came from there. And that's inspiring because you start to hear the history too, you know, like, I mean, you're reading it and then you're seeing a lot of these great artifacts in your book, but then you're hearing that history. And I love it, how it all comes together. And I think that's the magic of this book, Good Day, Sunshine State, is you pull all those experiences together.
Yeah. And influences and, like one of the things when I give my lectures it's a visual lecture. I have a PowerPoint presentation and you cannot tell this story without including a significant portion of the African-American experience down here in the South. And to have interviewed Kitty Oliver, to talk about how it took an act of courage for her to go see the Beatles by herself at the Gator Bowl, which as a young Black person was in what she called a zone of uncertainty. And you think about that, it's just hard to believe. And the picture I have in this presentation shows the Beatles before they're superstars opening up for Little Richard, and they're all embracing him. They're all sitting together, you know, in a nice cordial embrace. And in fact, as an aside, that's where they met 15-year-old Billy Preston. He was Little Richard's keyboard player there in Europe when the Beatles opened up for him. But it wasn't a big deal to them. And it was a big deal everywhere else. And, you know, in terms of ushering in all of these changes in America, these guys really went out on a limb. And I think that's what people need to understand, is that the Beatles weren't always the Beatles. And there's a time when nobody had heard of them. And they're coming on right at this significant, culturally significant time. But they took a lot of risk by saying, no, we're going to, you know, initiate these changes if you don't. And musically, absolutely. You know, they love Chuck Berry. They love Fats Domino. In fact, we talked about Coffee Butler in that jam session in Key West. And he goes, yep, I can remember for sure that was one of the songs we played was Fats Domino, Blueberry Hill, you know, because the Beatles loved it so much.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, these guys just brought the modern era to us from overseas. And isn't that interesting? So many American jazz artists, you know, who were discriminated against in the South would go over to Europe to be treated better. Yeah. And then once they became stars over there, we'd import them back, you know, to celebrate them as the great artists that they were. But it was just very indicative of the time. And I one of the other really wonderful stories was talking to Robert Lipsight, the correspondent for the New York Times, who was the only one in Cassius Clay's locker room with the Beatles as they're waiting to meet him.
A great story.
Pissed off, you know, because Cassius Clay's keeping them all waiting. And then the door opens, and here is this Greek god looking guy, you know, who was the young Cassius Clay. And they all met. And, you know, Lipsyte said to me, it was nothing short of the beginning of the 60s. Yeah. Being right there in that crappy little dank locker room in South Beach as the Beatles met Cassius Clay, arguably the greatest cultural figures of the 20th century. Yeah. And you think about Clay's stand against the Vietnam War. I mean, he went to prison and he gave up his heavyweight boxing title. You know, the Beatles denounced it, you know, the war, but, you know, they didn't really suffer the slings and arrows that, that Cassius Clay did.
Yeah. You, you do such a nice job in this book of setting, you know, the stage, not just, you know, the segregation of the South. And you, you just mentioned it, you know, of course, the Vietnam War, Cuban Missile Crisis, MLK. I mean, the proximity, how they were like literally within two buildings of each other at one point, assassinations of that era, Kennedy, Medgar Evers, I think around that time. What, you know, there's so much going on at this time. How much did that help? People were starving for music, right? I mean, people were starving for, you know, something to appeal to the soul. And how much of that really played? Did Larry get the sense that the Beatles felt that? Like they need something for the ears and the soul, musically.
I think really one of the best vignettes for that question, you know, came from Gail Cameron, the Life magazine reporter.
Yeah, yeah.
It wasn't so much that the Beatles tailored their songs to this need in America, but it was very serendipitous that it just happened that way. And it was like this perfect storm, which included a horribly tragic event, which was the death of Camelot with JFK's assassination. Mm-hmm. And talking to Gail Cameron was a revelation in terms of she was buddies with Jackie. Mm-hmm. And she told me when in the 1960 election, when the returns were coming in, she's just hanging out with Jackie and Hyannis in their house. There aren't all these media around, you know, so she got to be good, close friends with her. And the reason I bring that up is because, you know, after JFK's assassination, you know, she and, you know, Lowengard and all these iconic live photographers are having to cover this horrendous event of just a nation in shock for weeks after JFK's assassination. And then all of a sudden, you know, it's Christmas time of 63, and here come the Beatles, and you have this joyous song called, you know, I Want to Hold Your Hand. And it's funny too, you know, the opening vignette of the book, which really talks, is an encapsulation of what it was like for young people to hear the Beatles and their own joy after all this immense sadness, you know. And I think that's where the Beatles really served to get America out of this funk. And like Gail said, you know, it felt like we finally had permission to smile again. And they just went on from there. And the bottom line is, you know, it's not like they were some fluke or some flash in the pan, because their music was just so damn good. And think about all of the things they were doing, you know, on tour and going from hotel to hotel and all this madness. And yet they're still able to hunker down in places like the Hotel George V in Paris and write, you know, Can't Buy Me Love. And then while they're holidaying in South Florida here, John's writing a bunch of stuff for Hard Day's Night. It's just extraordinary how this music could just fall out of them at a time when they're so busy as it is. Oh, when they're filming Help and Day's Night, what, 8 weeks? And after they leave Florida, George is turning 21. You know, I got socks that old. It's amazing to me, you know, that they were achieving so much. And I don't think we can underestimate Brian's importance in all of this, and booking them on Ed Sullivan, and just having the instinct early on, these guys are going to be bigger than Elvis. He said that without smiling when they were nobody. And he knew.
The wholesome, I mean, yes, there were there's sex stories in here. There's all kinds of stuff. Yeah. the buddy's recommendations. That was pretty funny. I won't get into that.
Right. Later,
I was, that was a belly laugh, but that when the Beatles came to the Dresdner's house for dinner to thank Buddy and his family, that's just America right there.
Oh,
and
yeah.
When you heard that, I mean, that had, I mean, just reading about it, I got chills. Just a different time. Who does now?
Yeah. And now you can go on like Google Earth. And I had the address from the letter that Paul wrote to Buddy. So I looked it up on Google Earth and I'm like, my God, the Beatles came to their first American home cooked meal in this little house. You know, it's a cop's house. It's not going to be anything special, but that's fine. And they just had this wonderful get together. And then all of a sudden, someone decides they're going to make a massive cameo in that night. And I'll just leave it at that. I mentioned this person earlier.
This is great. Called,
and I'm like, okay, well, you're talking yourself into a chapter I've already written about the Beatles having dinner with their bodyguard. And this person who's been so notable in more recent times was the Dresdner's neighbor. And I'm like, you know, the synchronicity is really weird. And I'll tell you one other story along those lines. And that's with John Trusty, the first guy you meet in the book. And I found out about him on this website called meetthebeatlesforreal.com. And I was able to call him up, and he's still living in outside Chicago. And he goes, hey, so Bob, where are you from? And I said, oh, I'm from this little suburb of Orlando called Longwood. And he goes, oh, Longwood. Well, my sister lives in Longwood. And I'm like, wow, that's really cool. And he goes, have you ever heard of Needles Trail? I said, yeah, John, I live on Needles Court.
Wow.
And it turns out, like, his sister lived there, and, like, her step-grandson used to cut my grass.
Wow.
And it's just really odd, man. And that's that whole synchronicity thing where you see these seemingly disparate.
Yeah, yeah.
All of a sudden, it's starting. The stars are aligning. And, you know, it's just a message like, yeah, this thing is on the right track.
Yeah. You know, going back to the Ed Sullivan, you know, February 9th, 64, I mean, was just such a, you know, you mentioned Tom Petty. And I know, you know, there's so many icons of today who've talked about that moment, you know, Springsteen, you know, Little Steven of the E Street Band. I mean, oh gosh. I mean, there's millions of others, like, because I think around that time too, so many of that next generation, they would slow that record down to like maybe 30 or something like that and try to learn the licks. And it all started with that moment. And to think that these guys are just, they're in their 20s, early 20s, you know? And it was that transcending. I mean, do you think we'll ever have a moment like that again, where a whole generation is inspired by that one televised moment? I mean, it seems like
it's hard to imagine that happening, because there's so much media out there now.
Yeah.
70 million people watched those Sullivan appearances. You know, that put them right up there in the ratings with the Beverly Hillbillies, for God's sake.
Yeah.
but when you were asking that question, I was flashing back on my interview with Tom Ledden, who is just a wonderful man. And of course, he was in Mudcrutch with Tom Petty.
That's right.
And
yeah.
He said, we would deconstruct those records as soon as we would get them. And George was our guru from afar. He was teaching us all how to be lead guitarists. And that was like a, you know, a frying pan over the head. You know, it hadn't really occurred to me. And he said, you know, after the Beatles came on the scene, Gainesville, which is a place that had, you know, a handful of garage bands, all of a sudden had 40 or 50 after the Beatles, you know. And Elvis started it for young Tom Petty. Tom met him on a movie set in Ocala, which is just south of Gainesville. His uncle was a prop master, so he got to see Elvis up close. But the real person that started the moment was seeing the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. And to have interviewed like Tom's best friend growing up, and to, you know, he shows me Tom's boyhood home and saying, yeah, this is where Tom got out of the station wagon and said, oh my God, I just got to meet Elvis. Oh, man. And Tom Ledden saying, yeah, I still remember like it was yesterday when Tom and I were in the Epics and the Sundowners and all these garage bands. And but one of the important quotes and moments from that chapter is something Tom said in an email about the severity of the conflict between Tom and his dad, who was this no-nonsense crew cut insurance salesman. And I mean, it got really serious. And that's a nice tease for the book, you know, get the book and read it and you'll find out what it is. But that blew my mind. And even the John Trusty story too, about the night he heard the Beatles for the first time and he's out on this deserted highway, that was kind of said as an aside. And I'll go back to people who aspire to write and journal and who do blogs. You really need to listen actively and let that silence speak for itself sometimes, you know?
Yeah.
Don't feel like you have to fill the time with another question. Let that person think a little bit more and then maybe say something that'll just blow your mind, because it'll happen. It'll happen. And it happened in this writing this book several times.
Yeah, I remember Bob Dodson saying that for TV interviews. It's like, well, when you just stop, it forces the person to, then they start, they feel like they have a need to keep going. It's a fact, it works. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Really, you, up until that point, you know, didn't understand.
I just sit here and be quiet and force you guys to keep filling, you know, but no, you're totally right. In fact, Dodson was a big influence in my journalism career, along with the great Charles Kuralt. And I had a chance to actually work with Kuralt early on in my career. And yeah, those guys were all about being really good listeners and go after the primary sources, whatever you have to do. If you want to really write anything that is lasting, you really need to go to the source, whether it, you know, be documents from like the Flagler College Civil Rights Collection, which I was lucky, that's in St. Augustine. And that's where I found an interview with this crucial judge who made all of these important decisions, you know, and reading about Dr. King sleeping on the floor of this house of this lady who put him up there, and having to sing himself to sleep because he was so nervous because he knew he was going to be getting arrested the next morning. It really brings you into their consciousness of, you know, wow, this guy was a real human being that was scared to death about getting arrested the next day, as he should be.
Oh yeah.
And you know, the white reverend who was right there with him and got the crap beat out of him for no reason. And they testified together in federal court. And this reverend, in several steps, his experience ended up being reported on the floor of the Senate by George McGovern. And that started the dominoes falling for the Civil Rights Act. So you see how little acts of courage have big results.
Yeah. One thing that jumped out, we were talking about Tom Petty a minute ago, and I was reminded of the fact that, like, Don Felder of the Eagles had given Tom Petty some early guitar lessons, and Don Felder said some pretty, you know, powerful things about the Beatles' influence too. And I started putting it all together in my head and picturing, you know, Don Felder and Tom Petty working on guitar, and Don Felder's teaching, but like, they're both thinking George Harrison, right? They're both thinking in that moment. How awesome, you know?
Like, they worked together at Lipham Music in Gainesville, along with Bernie Ledden, who was in the guitar section. Here's three future Rock and Roll Hall of Famers.
Insane, yeah.
And this Lipham guy, Buster, would let the musicians get stuff on, you know, with IOUs.
Amazing.
And, you know, there was a check on the wall from Dwayne Allman after they got some gear stolen and they needed some on the way to a gig down in South Florida. Buster hooks them up with the stuff. So, yeah, I love those kind of stories. Yeah. And to think that Felder actually taught young Tom Petty a little bit of guitar at Lipham Music is just
amazing. Yeah, it really is. Yeah.
But it goes to the history and the roots of great rock and roll guitarists in Florida, not just the South, in Florida.
Florida, right.
it is the cradle of guitar rock, I would say, in our country. And I could tick you off, you know, eight guitarists from seminal bands who were either born and bred here or have significant roots here. Bo Diddley being one.
Yeah.
That sounds like a good idea for a book.
I was going to say, that's a documentary, right there. Yeah, yeah.
But let's get the movie going on this one first.
Yeah, that's right.
I do think Larry's story especially is right out of Almost Famous, you know, Cameron Crowe.
Right. Yeah.
And his story of traveling with the Allman Brothers. And I think Larry's story is actually much larger, broader, and important. And we could do the same thing with that. And I'm all in. If any producers are listening, I'm all in. And I told Larry the same thing. And I said, don't be modest. Your story is fantastic. You know,
absolutely. It's just a great, you got a family man, you know, that's stuck, you know, for several weeks, you know, being their bodyguard. You have Larry, there's I mean, you don't want to spread it too thin amongst a whole bunch of people, but it's just there's some really, really juicy characters there that,
Buddy loved those guys. And, you know, he ends up rooming with George because he's not getting any sleep, having to go back and forth to his house. You know, I mean, who does that? And Buddy is, he's just the perfect kind of guy, but he could be a hard ass too, you know. And one night when George gets back late, you know, and he's trying to figure out what happened is a really funny vignette too, you know. But all this is all for a cop who I think was making $3 an hour on this extra duty, you know.
Well, this story takes place, I think by my math, like 59 years ago, so early 60s. How difficult, Bob, does it make storytelling when a lot of the principals are no longer with us? You know, many others have gone on, you know, to the four corners of the earth. Does that ever make you shy away or make the process of writing something too difficult?
I wouldn't say necessarily that, but it does show the urgency to capture these stories before these folks aren't with us anymore. But I'm a big, you know, person of going into archives, and I mentioned the, you know, civil rights collection down here at Flagler College, you know, in St. Augustine. Letters can be very important. Any of these primary source documents are just like gold. And one of the books I wrote was about the pioneers of Tupperware. And I know that sounds crazy, but that's a huge story here in Central Florida. This is where Tupperware Home Parties was founded. And I was able to travel to the Smithsonian, and I spent a week there. And so many of Tupper and this wonderful saleswoman who came up with the home party system, Brownie Wise, you know, their memos, their letters. So, you know, there's direct quotes. So all of a sudden you know, you can put words out there, you know, this is them talking to each other via these letters and memos. So having that stuff and take it to your own family histories, for instance, that's why it's so important to keep, you know, these letters and, you know, videos and things like that, because it does put you right back in the time. And the generosity of people like Larry Kane, who's just a marvel. You follow him on Twitter, he's still out there, you know, he's still doing his thing, you know, and he's writing fantastic book reviews of which I'm not sure I'm worthy, but I sure was flattered. But yeah, so where there's a will, there's a way. But if you find yourself kind of aggregating too much of a secondary source kind of thing, maybe too many newspapers, that's another thing, newspapers.com. Go to that, and you get the quotes from that. You know, that would be my secondary if I couldn't have a primary. So that's kind of a roadmap to it. You know,
we don't do such a hot job with buildings though, and landmarks in this country, like Europe, other places.
Yeah, it's awful.
Do we do a good job though with this kind of stuff? Does America keep good history?
I think some places do. Like for instance, I talked about Macon, Georgia, and you know, they have such reverence for, you know, Little Richards from there. You know, the Allmans moved up there and did their recording. And I sure wish we did a better job here in Florida, because we have so many amazing artists who are from down here, but people don't know it because we're always associated with theme parks and beaches and all this other stuff, which is an important driver to our economy. But, you know, we sometimes get the short shrift about the Florida man and all that ridiculous crap.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of great artists who came from down here. You know, I could bore you to death telling you those stories, but it is important to remember those stories along the way. And especially for people who live down in the state, which has almost 20 million people now, it gives you a better sense of roots and belonging. Yeah. To know, yeah, there was history before Walt Disney. Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
Zeppelin played Orlando before Disney.
Right, right. Well, even wow. The songwriter said, we were talking with, I think, Desmond Child a couple times, and who's written with a lot of people, and he's, you know, he talked about that the Cuban, you know, influence. I mean, he's Cuban and then living there and picking up rhythm and all those different ideas and things like that. So even writers who have worked with some of these, you know, premier artists too, you know, have that Florida connection as well. And the culture and the tradition and all of those things just coming together. It's amazing how a region can inspire so much musically, culturally, and all of that.
It's a melting pot.
Yeah, really is. Yeah.
Not about it. And it reminds me of Bernie Ledden talking about Gainesville.
Yep.
And he said, you know, because there are so many people coming into the university, like his dad was a professor and they moved there from Southern California. And Tom Petty was born and bred there. He goes, it's like a cauldron of creativity. All these different, you know, cultures mixing. And certainly the same is true here in the state of Florida.
Yep.
It does. Florida has, I mean, maybe the answer to your question is, you know, like Florida's transient by nature. You know, there are people that, like myself, come there for 5 years and then take off, go somewhere else, and take a lot of that.
We still haven't forgiven you for that, by the way.
I'm sorry. I didn't want to. No. I had to. No.
Yeah, Mr. As fancy up there.
Uh-huh. As much as I love Wesh, I couldn't make the money that I needed to buy all the records I want. No,
we all needed to move on. We
stack up the piles.
That is true.
Yeah.
The magic of the Beatles, Bob, and we'll let you go, but the magic of the Beatles, I didn't really get when I was younger, cause I was always for the brighter, shinier object at the time. It really, if there is one, but I really developed the respect for them, unfortunately, through a cover band that I saw in Philly when I was working on a story. And these guys gave it 110%. They were called the Beat Tells. And seeing the crowd's reaction, you know, so many years later, and being on stage and shooting them and hearing these songs and Twist and Shout cut through me, I started to get emotional. Then I realized that I went out and bought all the early Beatles records right after that, because I realized that there's a power to these songs. There's a power to this music that I can't describe.
Yeah, to me, it's the freshness. And I try to describe it in the last chapter of the book about how they just experienced in them listening to their music, maybe having encounters with them. They're like markers in our lives. And that's really the way I put it, you know, and that's what the last chapter of the book is attempting to see why the Beatles are so important to people. And when you read, like I read on YouTube that I played in my life to my mom in the last moments of her life, you know, it's like, wow, you know, that's important stuff. And it shows to you how embedded they are in our society and in our culture. And I think part of it was we weren't so fragmented with the internet and everything back when they came to be, but it's also the brilliance of their music and their willingness to just constantly evolve, whether you liked it or not. You know, they put a lot into less than a decade together in the 60s. And I think that's, you know, forever why they will always be the Beatles, and they will continue to resonate generation to generation, just like they did with you.
Yeah. Boy, oh boy, man, this is, we got a million questions here. Good day.
Yeah.
Sunshine State, How the Beatles Rocked Florida, right there. That's it. Hey, we got a triple threat right there on all screens.
There you go. It's a hat
yeah,
trick.
That's yeah. right. I love it. But the great Bob Keeling, man, oh man, this is, you know, such a joy, man. Thank you for taking the time and sharing this with us. And get this book. You'll love it. You can order, get it wherever you get books. Amazon, amazing wherever book. You get books. It's incredible. It's awesome.
Well, Dave, Shane, you guys are the best. And thank you for your stewardship to wanting to dig so much deeper, you know, behind the music, as it were.
Yeah.
And here's to four more, many more years you know, your scholarship. And thank you for having me.
Great. Thank you so much, sir.
Just when you don't think the Beatles story can get advanced, you know, here comes this. And seriously, this is a tremendous read. You got to check it out.
And it's Beatles an easy, fans. It flows. It's an easy read too. Like it flows. It just, I mean, you know, it's perfect. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, we're going to get down to it now. Yeah. You know, this is from a former broadcaster, you know, they'd always tell me write tight, get
right,
to it.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, that those words are always in the back of my mind.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you, Bob.
Bob, thank you so much, sir.
Thank you guys very much. It was a pleasure.
Yeah.